This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the pod staff. With me today, I have Mr. Ian May. Ian has an extensive sales background, very successful sales background, and he is a executive business and sales coach for more specifically ADHDers like myself. So I don't want to steal your thunder, Ian, but go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you hit the nail on the head of a lot of outward successes in my career and a lot of different formats of my life. But for a good majority of that career, I was still very much so suffering quietly with unmanaged ADHD patterns, something that was really problematic for me. I was actually late diagnosed in my late 20s. But even then, when I went to get my first diagnosis, it was me thinking I was manipulating the system to get some stimulant medications, mm-hmm. thinking that this was going to be my leg up and I'm going to turn on, you know, my intensity. And so what's funny is that I was masking in that meeting, pretending to have ADHD, when in reality it was like, no, I actually do have ADHD. This was something I wasn't giving enough energy and attention to. So for me personally, despite the fact that I had a diagnosis, I didn't take it seriously, didn't take mental health seriously. I was very much so go, go, go intensity all the time. And in 2020, I had essentially the biggest burnout that I ever had. I got laid off from my corporate job due to the economic impact of COVID, which was nice that they put that on paper. But in all reality, if I had stuck around at the business, I probably wouldn't have hit metrics. I was already on my downward spiral. So in 2020, I essentially had was struggling with alcohol, was struggling with phone and internet addiction to the nature of pornography and cyber sex, which is awesome to have to air my dirty laundry on the infinite internet. Yeah, my dirty laundry, maybe some dirty socks we'll have to talk about. But we can have some levity to it too, right? It doesn't have to be all serious all the time. I also am a self-proclaimed LinkedIn comment comedian. So I don't take myself too seriously. I do take the work pretty seriously though. So with all that, I mean, coming out of that place of burnout, I tried coming out of that, putting myself into another job that was a high performing sales job. I was just hyper focusing on work, thinking I just need to climb this mountaintop. I'll be back in the saddle. I'll be good. But I was still using pressure, stress, anxiety to fuel that intensity. And after about 6 months, I closed, maybe it was a full year in that role, I closed the biggest deal in company history at the time, which, mind you, wasn't necessarily a massive deal, but it was probably 20 or 30 times the average deal size. So it was pretty sizable. That night, I lost more sleep. Super stressed, felt so much crippling anxiety, because I was like, wait, I have to go find three or four more of these over the course of the next 3 to 4 months if I'm going to hit my next number, my next target, my next hill that I had to climb. And I did not have it in me, right? The deals were there, the accounts were there, and I just was so overwhelmed that I should be celebrating. Like, I should be on the top of this mountain that I'm being heralded for, and there's bells ringing within all of the different channels. And I felt so much shame, anxiety, stress, and overwhelm. And so from that place of burnout, I took a step back from that sales role. I moved into a different role that didn't require as much of my intensity and energy, that had a lot of prior knowledge to be able to build that role. Like, in all seriousness, I was probably gone back 10 years in my career to land in that particular position, but was able to then focus on this inner journey of understanding my ADHD brain, understanding addiction, understanding all these ways that I was not managing my addictions well, and essentially building up a good amount of patterns and strategies and awareness for the neurobiology, behavioral psychology. How do you actually build and recreate a new identity? Because this old one, this high performer thing, mantra that I just, ooh, rah, tech sales bro, lived my life around, wasn't serving me anymore. And in fact, every time I would try to show up with that and that mask would appear again, trying to be ooh-rah tech sales bro, I would get sick to my stomach. I'd literally want to vomit when I'd show up in the office and that version of me would show up again. And it was crippling. It was just absolutely could not be that person anymore. And so from that started my journey of self-exploration. And now I take all of those learnings and share that with my clients who are also high-performing, highly successful, but quietly suffering ADHD professionals.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I like the quietly suffering but highly performing, because I just to be honest on for me, you know, that whenever we had our first call just to meet each other, that was something that stuck with me until we're having this conversation today, and I was just really excited to you know, have you come on. So appreciate you doing that. And this one's not only for our listeners, but this one is for me too. So I will be listening with everyone.
that's the beauty of having a podcast is yeah. you get to have the opportunities of free coaching if you need it.
yeah, definitely. And I think I can just relate a lot to a couple of things you said. Like, you closed the biggest deal in company history, and that was like one of the worst days for you. Mm-hmm. And then you wanted to, you know, kind of go back and, or I guess your mind brought you back a little bit to that rah-rah tech sales bro. I can literally picture myself in that environment, and you know, people are, you know, celebrating, you're closing deals, you're having these wrap ups, and honestly, like, I don't think there's anything wrong. I thought it was awesome, but I don't think outgrowing is the word for me. It could be, but I think it's just maybe, what do you think about just allowing room for yourself to evolve and change to where what you were doing before isn't wrong by any means. It's just now, you know, starting a new business, you know, we've talked about that a little bit. It just kind of feels like there's an evolution that my inner self was fighting against. And it still is. It definitely still is, because your brain tells you one thing, your heart tells you the other, and then they flop. And you don't really know what direction to go sometimes.
Yeah, so there's a pretty common story, I think, amongst those highly successful but quietly suffering professionals, that essentially when you reach a point of burnout where it's not the output. The output was actually never the issue in the first place. So what you even noted of, hey, ringing the bell when you close a deal, that wasn't the issue. Trying to achieve something and climb a mountaintop, that wasn't the issue. In fact, I now, in my coaching business, work just as hard, if not harder, in the way that I'm showing up in my business. But the issue and where the burnout happens is, what was the fuel that was driving it in the first place? And so the issue is that usually the fuel is coming from insecurity, overwhelm, fear, worry, stress, pressure. And the problem with that is that might have gotten you started in your career in the trajectory of, like, need to prove myself, ooh-rah, like, someday I'm going to be important. And the difficulty of that is, like, that fuel does not last for very long. It burns hot, but it doesn't burn forever. And so that evolution that you're talking about is, okay, how do I now turn on intensity from a place of joy, excitement, fulfillment, encouragement, empowerment, any languages that you use that really align with your values? And so this whole process, this uncovering and chipping away at what the tech sales bro was doing, who's the real Ian? Who's the real version of me underlying all of this? That maybe there's actually some real values that he was attempting to achieve in that output, but wasn't actually being fueled by it. What parts of me actually were being lit up in that work? And how do I actually spend more time honoring those values more consistently, more effectively, with much more connection with, like, the deepest version of myself? Now, all of that sounds really sort of like hand wavy woo-saw spiritually. And mind you, like, I do have a faith bend that directs a lot of my capital P purpose in life. But also at the same time, the trajectory that I take on this is, how can we get our neurobiology to participate in that? because I think oftentimes for people with ADHD, because ADHD is happening in the brain, it is a neural development. We have to start in the nervous system. We have to start in the brain. And the mechanisms of the brain are very clear with what the ADHD experience is like, what's happening in the ADHD brain. So I can actually start there and work my way to these esoteric ideas of values and performance and purpose, but I can lead from this place of what's happening in my nervous system to notice when I am blocked, when my brain is shutting off to boring and mundane tasks, and when I am stuck in these amygdala patterns of fear of appearing incompetent, fear of not being enough, fear, you know, any number of fears that come up, but usually spin your wheels. There was a time though when that lit you up and that got you to perform. And now all of a sudden ringing the bell used to make you feel up here, and then you ring the bell enough times, the novelty wears off. And I can only ring the bell. The first time I closed a $300 deal, whoo, ring the bell, celebrate me. And then inevitably it's just like, what's a $300 deal? It needs to be a $3,000 deal. And then enough $3,000 deals, and it's $30,000 and $300,000 and $3 million. Like, you can see though that all of a sudden, like, your brain's just not turning on the same way that it used to. And inevitably all that's left is the fear, anxiety, worry, stressors, pressure.
Yeah. And another thing that came to mind too is like, even that, that coach or mentor or leader that was like, hey man, you're doing a lot better last month. Like, that used to just be like, oh yeah, no, my competitive nature, no, that's not going to happen. And so like it worked. And then, the last leader that I had, he was just trying to do that because he's used to sales reps being, very motivated by things like that. And I just thought, this doesn't work for me anymore. I need to find other things that work, because his approval no longer really drove me when, like, you know, right or wrong, that approval might have driven me for a while, really.
Yeah. So there's something that happens. It's called counterwill, where when somebody is trying to give you good advice, when somebody is trying to be helpful, right? Your manager, like, he's probably thinking like, I'm trying to be an encouragement, I'm trying to motivate him, I'm pushing him, and I'm going to bring the best out of him. But as soon as that person stops to feel safe, anything they say, your brain is not receiving and your brain is turned off to. Like, it's this act of teenage rebellion to our parents. And the problem is that now all of a sudden starts to happen in the workplace with the manager, and your daddy issues are showing up with your one-on-ones. Sorry, I'm not saying that that's what your struggles were, but you can see though that like that counterwill all of a sudden makes it to where he's talking and there's nothing making it through. And he's like, hey, where are we at with this account? Blah, blah. And make sure that these are your takeaways from this meeting. And your brain's not actually honing in on that. So all of a sudden you come back to the same one-on-one a week later. Hey, where are we at with the blah, blah, blah account? And you're just like, oh shoot, I was supposed to send an update to them. Oh, I was supposed to check in with them with that. And now I'm missing some key performance indicators that I actually am objectively lacking on. And I want to blame my manager for him being so toxic, when in reality, it's like, I'm the problem. My nervous system is the problem. It's not showing up the way that it used to. Now I'm having this identity crisis of, maybe I'm not the performer I thought that I was. Downward spiral we go.
Well, and even if you still are, it's just, even if like, you're a top performer and then you stay a top performer, but you're not like, nothing's changing for you. You're just kind of staying at that top performer. It does kind of feel like you're going backwards almost, especially for someone who is, you know, usually highly motivated and highly detail oriented, like you said, and then you're slacking, and then you're like, there's almost a sense of pride with it. Whenever you're talking to a manager that asks you for something twice that you didn't do, where you're like, don't you know that I've been performing for years? Why do you think you need to ask me that? Mm-hmm. And
why are you micromanaging me?
Job. Yeah. Like, I'm the exception to the rule. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And I think that's the part where within the ADHD experience, like, we can start to address, hey, why am I struggling to focus? Why am I struggling to follow through with tasks that I even agreed to, right? Like, I told them, yeah, I'm going to get back to you on that. Yeah, I will next week. I will have X, Y, and Z things. But if our brain is still stuck in that pattern of overwhelm, that pattern of pressure and stress and anxiety, if I don't have a very clear upside, to why the task matters. I'm not able to tap into the natural intrinsic dopamine associated with those tasks, then yeah, I'm all of a sudden going to be just stuck downward spiraling. And so some of these are just like practical habits and applications of like just creating some awareness of, hey, where's my energy at relative to this task? And the more clear I can get about what the upside actually is versus, hey, what are the internal stories that I'm noticing? What is the belief that I have about myself relative to this task? And for most people, the difficulty is inevitably the upside is, congrats, you're an adult. Congrats, you get to keep your job. And the downside is criticism, rejection, you know, constantly being belittled for what you're not doing, right? And our brains will hyper-focus on all of the negatives. And all of a sudden, the upside starts to get smaller and smaller and smaller in our purview.
Do you think that misalignment of energy is the start of the coping mechanisms that come about?
Yeah. So more than likely, with ADHD historically, all we looked at were behaviors, right? We looked at the distraction. We looked at the dopamine seeking with, you know, checking your phone, being addicted to your phone, the snacking, sugar craving. Like, we used to just look at the output behaviors. But in reality, those output behaviors are actually giving us a little bit of a heat map for some things that you're associating with psychological safety. It's not just dopamine doesn't just come from pleasure and rewarding pleasure. It also is predicting safety. And so that peanut butter and jelly sandwich that you're going and eating two or three of them during your 2 o'clock break, there might actually be some associations with that. Yes, obviously there's a release in dopamine from the sugar and fat combined, but hey, why is peanut butter and jelly sandwiches so emotionally safe for you? Like, why are you turning to that? Oh, okay. That's what I used to eat when I was with my family. And I'm equating this emotional sense of safety with this behavior and this activity. And that feels safer than the project that I'm supposed to be working on.
Yeah. Right. And yeah. Like, for me, that just, you know, I just thought of like all your family being around, your friends and stuff, whatever, on Thanksgiving and getting so full. And then you just kind of like nod off in a chair. That's a very weird thing that we do, but it's a very safe thing because the environment was safe. So that association probably does that too for, you know, especially like ultra binge eaters, to where laying down, like, it's just the old stereotype, bag of potato chips on the couch. Like, it's probably a safe feeling.
Yeah. I mean, try being on a diet during Thanksgiving, right? Almost nobody does that because usually the issue is like, oh, hey, people are going to judge me. They're like, why are you not eating? It's Thanksgiving. We all eat. That's what we do. So now the story I'm telling myself is, if I don't eat what they eat, I'm not accepted. I don't have belonging, tribalism. All of that triggers this cascade of fear, anxiety, worry, insecurity. And so, yeah, having the piece of pie feels safer, not just from the dopamine and stimulation of the sugar itself, but from the community and belonging that I'm getting from all of those things.
Yeah. And I feel like that just is directly with, you know, I think kind of what I've seen a trend on your social media and stuff like that on LinkedIn is just like the interrupting the patterns, because those are all patterns that we're associating things with. And they're just ways of thinking and like neural pathways that we've developed. So what's like a typical, if you're doing a coaching session with someone, like what's a typical start to interrupting that pattern?
Yeah. So with any new client that I connect with, part of the strategy of what I'm giving them is giving them more language to use for things to break the interrupt, right? Because part of the challenge that most people have is they're sort of mindlessly operating within these automated patterns, right? Mindlessly scrolling, mindlessly eating the food, mindlessly doing anything but the tasks that they're supposed to be doing. And so part of the skill is just noticing and not just thinking the thing, but hearing yourself say the thing. And so oftentimes what happens, this comes from this theory called hemispherical lateralization, where you have your right hemisphere is more of your creative part of your brain, is more of the emotional feeling part of your brain, and then your left hemisphere is more of the logical executive function. There are some caveats to this, right? Both hemispheres are always active, but part of the problem that we run into with ADHD is I might be creatively thinking about all the ways I'm going to die. I'm creatively thinking about all the ways that this presentation is going to go wrong, or I'm ruminating about all of the different dumb things I said on the pipeline update meeting, and my manager thinks I'm an idiot, or I said the wrong thing in this time and I'm never going to be successful, and spiral, spiral, spiral. But all of those things are happening in the right hemisphere of the brain, where the emotions are heavy and our amygdala is extremely active. The problem then is that I'm not getting dopamine, norepinephrine, and blood flow to the executive part of my brain. So by saying I am noticing, hearing myself say I am noticing, it's actually using a different part of the brain than the thinking, spiraling part of my brain. So by saying, oh, hey, I'm noticing that I'm looking at LinkedIn on my computer and pull up LinkedIn on my phone. I call that my double tap. Going back to my Call of Duty bro days. Oh, hey, I'm noticing the double tap. Oh, I'm noticing the I'm not good enough story. Oh, I'm noticing the fear of incompetence story. Oh, I'm noticing the I feel inadequate story. Oh, I'm noticing the insecurity around money story. The sooner I can notice and say out loud that I am noticing, the sooner I can slowly but surely start moving more and more of the parts of my brain that can put the hand back on the wheel for executive function, reasoning, logic, and so on. The challenge that people with ADHD have is they don't have a lot of interoception, so that ability to name their internal experience. And so early on, it's just giving them more language to explain it. And sometimes you don't know what you're feeling. I don't know what I'm blocked by. I just feel numb. I just feel apathy. Perfect. I'm noticing the apathy. I just feel numb to the task that's in front of me. It's not, I know that it's important logically. I know that there's tasks around it that's logically there. All right, I'm noticing the apathy. Noticing like other parts of the visceral experience. I'm feeling some pressure in my temple that like, oh, there's noticing my blood pressure, noticing heart rates elevated, noticing some tension in my jaw, which might be an indication of cortisol and adrenaline, noticing some shakiness in my hands. I am noticing. Oh, hey, I'm noticing that. And so now that I'm noticing, then I can take some more effective action to dissipate that visceral experience or dissipate the intensity of those intrusive thoughts and being able to practice those skills. But for the first week, it's literally just, hey, we need to give more language to your internal experience so we can quickly create those breakpoints.
Yeah, I had a therapist tell me one time that even if you just name things like that that creep up to where you're naming them a person's name or just like a human name, because my question to her was, well, what if I don't know what to call it? She's like, it doesn't have to be the accurate term. It doesn't have to be shaky, blood pressure, apathy. It doesn't have to be all that. It can literally be Fred. Like, as long as you know what to associate with it. And I've used that and it's worked, because sometimes it takes a little bit to understand what to actually call it. So, but you need to call it something to name it, like you said.
So one of the strategies that I like to use, giving things a name, but sometimes when I notice any intrusive thought, I will repeat it in Mickey Mouse's voice. And one, it creates a little bit of levity around it, like some silliness, which mobilizes dopamine, helps me sort of like get playful with it. I'm not shaming myself for having the thought, because oftentimes that's what happens. You have an intrusive thought and we go, you can't think like that. What's wrong with you? Why can't you just focus? And it's like, well, all I'm doing is just keeping the amygdala active. I'm not slowing down the activity of the amygdala by doing that.
Yeah, instead of letting it pass through, like is recommended by any professional. But why is that just so hard? Like, I've struggled with that a lot, because I don't know if it's an ADHD thing or just a human thing in general. But I mean, intrusive thoughts sometimes really, you can go down a spiral. Like sometimes I do. I'll have a whole day not necessarily taken out. I'm still productive, like you're talking about, but my brain is thinking about some weird thought or dream or something that I had earlier in the day or yesterday, and I'm just stuck on it, like hyper fixated on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So everybody has an inner critic. Everybody has intrusive thoughts. For the ADHD experience, it's the volume and frequency of those intrusive thoughts. So for the ADHD experience, if we look at the nervous system of the ADHD brain, typically we have higher amounts of dopamine, norepinephrine, and blood flow around the amygdala and the hippocampus. And it's called the basal ganglia, but the parts of our brain that's more emotional. And so the difficulty with that is when you have heightened amygdala activity, it narrows your focus a ton. And so the problem is that our focus, though, it's designed for you to be able to look at what the attacks are coming from. Oh, the bush is over there. That might be a lion, tiger, or a bear. Or if I'm in the middle of a fight with a bear, obviously I'm not thinking about my taxes. I'm hyper-focused on fighting the bear.
Yeah.
And so when the amygdala is active, it's designed to hone in your focus, which is why people with ADHD actually typically do well in emergency situation, because it's like, hey, I'm mobilizing dopamine, norepinephrine, the adrenaline is helping move some of that to my frontal lobe. I know that this is the only problem that matters right now in this emergency. And so they handle it. So you can actually see. Oh, yeah.
The aftermath is when it's like an hour, 2 hours later, and then your heart's racing like it should have been for most people during the event.
Yeah, the stimulus to fatigue ratio, the fatigue is overwhelming and the crash afterwards is significant. Yeah. But so when you talk about how many thoughts are coming through, the problem when you have a heightened amygdala just chronically is that, I don't know if you remember those old school toys that was a I think it was called like a viewpoint, where you hold it up and you click the thing and it changes the image.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember.
For the ADHD brain, our brain is just cycling image, 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 image. And so the problem is when somebody's just like, hey, what are you thinking right now? Hey, what's going on? What are you thinking? You're like, I don't even know, because I was just thinking about the fact that I've got this hole in my sock. I'm thinking about the fact that the window's open and the breeze is coming in. It's kind of awkward. Yeah. I'm noticing that this weird light bulb keeps going off and the fan is doing this weird squeaky noise. And I can't seem to get my keyboard to have this one key unstuck. And I forgot that I haven't emailed Joe in accounting. So what am I thinking about? Get a pen, because you're going to be sitting here for a while. Versus, again, in this skill that we developed, isn't necessarily name every single one of those thoughts. I would just slow down enough to be able to say, oh, I'm noticing the chaotic thoughts. Oh, hey, I'm noticing black and white thinking. Oh, I'm noticing I'm struggling to unhook. Like, and even that is enough to then, what do I have to do to calm and slow down the amygdala activity? What do I have to do to mobilize a sustainable dopamine to my frontal lobe? Enough to then be able to take more effective action on what's in front of me, what I've deemed to be a priority. And all of those things are skills. And so with the ADHD experience, with that viewpoint scroller, when you have heightened amygdala activity, everything is being given equal priority. And so the problem, even with the language of ADHD, attention deficit, is that we don't have a deficit of attention. We actually have hyper amounts of attention. And the problem is our brain is giving equal attention to every stimulus that's coming in. We can't turn on hyperfocus until we essentially deprioritize every other stimulus, then the one key thing that we want to lock in on. And when we do, hyperfocus. Oh man, I can lock in for hours, but I don't know how to do it on demand. It happens by accident.
Well, yeah. I mean, it can sort of happen by on demand. Like, it can start on demand, but then you go to something else. But sometimes, you know, I'll be sitting in this very chair, I'll be like, yeah, I'm going to sit down and do a couple of things for 2 hours. 7 hours goes by, and I'm like, now I'm wired. So now I'm probably going another 3 hours, because I'm like, well, I'm already in this mode, so I need to take advantage of this mode, because it may not be back tomorrow. It might take a day or two.
Yeah. So anytime that you run into any binge, you just said a binge of focus, which is like, why is that a bad thing? That's a good thing. The difficulty is that part of your brain is perceiving some resource as scarce, some resource, any resource. So when you binge food, your emotional relationship with food is that whatever that emotional relationship is, you're binging the thing that you think is scarce, which might be emotional connection, community, belonging. When I have cake, that's usually when I'm hanging out and celebrating somebody and I'm in community. But now it's 10 o'clock at night. There isn't a party happening. I'm just by myself slamming this cake.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm actually perceiving.
Birthday, so I was recently there.
Best thing that you can do, give their leftover cake to all of your neighbors. Oh, hey, we have some leftover cake. So I'm sharing with community and I'm not imbibing in all of it myself. Random tidbit support. But so the thing about this binging that's happening is that there's some resource that you're perceiving as being scarce. In this case, the resource that you're perceiving as scarce is focus. Because you even just said it, I don't know the next time I'm going to be able to lock in like this. So now I'm having trouble unhooking from focus. And my wife is saying, hey, it's 5 o'clock. You promised that you'd hang out with the family. And you're like, still thinking about work. I'm on my phone still. Well, I'm supposed to be dad. And now I feel pissed off and frustrated with myself because I'm lamenting my family, because it's like, well, if I didn't have a family, I'd be successful and I'd be a millionaire by now, because I'd be able to lock in whenever and however I want. And Spiral.
It's almost like being able to like, I'm very good, and you kind of just described this too. I'm very good at putting myself physically where I need to be. Mm-hmm. If I usually lock in this chair or outside or wherever, then I'm really good at putting myself there. If I know I need to, I have a commitment that I need to make, I make that commitment 90% of the time or more, and I'm there. But it's the making the mind follow where your feet are is the ultra challenging part. And I wanted to mention the mindless tasks again, because you mentioned those and I have mixed feelings about it, because the mindless tasks for me are very tough most of the time. However, I realized recently that I was scrolling Instagram, like I would be like dozing off and be like, come to, and just like keep scrolling. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that went on for a while. And I looked at screen time and stuff, and that really concerned me. Mm-hmm. So I cut out, you know, that, and I cut out some other things that were mindless tasks and everything like that. And then what I realized is when I cut every mindless task out, then I was like ultra focus mode, not fun to be around, stuff like that. So it's almost finding that balance between like, what's the least unhealthy mindless task that I can still allow myself to do, but not too much of it, and at the right times, and to where it doesn't affect other things.
Wow. So there's a lot to pull over from that, because one of the things that you are likely experiencing right now is justification for whatever is your thing that you imbibe in. And so what's interesting is that when it comes to addictions in general, the difficulty with addictions is that we all agree, okay, dopamine reinforces pleasure and safety, right? So I'm reinforcing behavior with that. The challenge, though, is when we have these mindless tasks that we do, typically it actually requires very little dopamine once we have a behavior that's been reinforced enough that actually dopamine's not required at all for me to imbibe in the task, for me to imbibe in whatever that thing is. And so you could be completely drained of dopamine from doing all of the positive things. You worked hard today, you got after it. You, for me personally, like getting up on stage and speaking and leading a 3-hour workshop, and I'm energized for that. And I'm riding this high for hours on end. And I come down, I'm crashing from that. My dopamine stores are now painfully low. And yet I have no energy to get up out of bed. I have no energy to do anything but insert my sort of mindless addictions that I might have. Despite the fact that I don't have any dopamine, I still have energy to do those things. I still have energy to all of a sudden make a trip to the grocery store and buy 2 pizzas and sit with that. I have those types of binging patterns of behaviors is people are often like, I don't know what I was thinking. I was numb. I wasn't even in my own head. Like there was nothing happening. And so this is actually something that's called frontal lobe hijacking or executive function hijack. But it's because of the fact that you don't need any dopamine for that behavior to happen. So for the ADHD experience, it's like you can be low dopamine and still imbibing in whatever that thing is. The challenge, though, is the fact that when you actually imbibe in that behavior, your brain is going to get dopamine. And so now all of a sudden, for this infinitesimal brief moment in time, your frontal lobe turns on. And now when you have executive function happening, that executive function is either going to shame yourself for how you got that dopamine or justify it. Right. And so the difficulty is that if I'm really dysregulated emotionally, my amygdala is really active, and now all of a sudden I get the dopamine to my frontal lobe and the shame story comes up, all I'm doing is continuing to fuel the amygdala activity.
What is it with the shame? I don't understand.
Yeah. So
I experienced it, but I have heard this from so many people where it's like that shame build up. And typically it's people with, ADHD or substance abuse patterns, which I feel like that's linked a lot of times. So it's almost like even if one's misdiagnosed, it's probably correlated.
Yeah. So there's, I think, I can't remember what the exact numbers are, but I believe there is a 3 times likelihood that if you struggle with substance abuse disorders of any kind, that you likely have ADHD. So it already kind of puts you in this category of risk for dopamine dysregulation. So that's one caveat to it. Not a fun one. Don't love that about the ADHD experience. The other part of this, though, when you talk about the shame story, is that very commonly with the ADHD experience, like we have a lot of identity issues where we're treating our ADHD experience as a flaw, something that's wrong with us, something that needs to be fixed. And so shame in general, you know, you look at it from an emotional scenario, is that usually shame comes with guilt and then an identity association with the guilt and with the emotion itself. And so it's not to say that like, oh, I messed up and I did something bad. It's I'm a bad person. I'm an addict. And there's a strong identity association that you've created around it. And again, the difficulty is that an identity really is just a thought that you've repeated and reinforced enough times about yourself and who you are in the world. So like even this part of like our thoughts, we can either reinforce or we can disincentivize and no longer reinforce. And identities and beliefs are really just thoughts that we've repeated and reinforced with enough repetitions that now it's defining the nature of the world and who we are inside of it. I don't know that I really answered your question.
No, I mean, I think there's a million ways to answer that question too. And I think that's definitely one of them. It's just always been fascinating to me, the shame piece, in my life and the people that I'm close to, because there's also the other side of people that don't really have all these, like that probably would listen to this episode and be like, meh,
sure.
They don't have a whole lot of shit. They can go say something, do something, whatever. And you could even be like, hey man, that didn't seem like, it seemed a little embarrassing. And they're like, what do you mean? What? Or they go out and they go on a bender for 3 days. And then they wake up Monday morning and they're like, that was a fun weekend. Let's go to work. And there's no like thoughts replay. There's no, did I say something? Did I do something? There's nothing. And
so that's the other side of the pendulum though.
Yeah.
Right. And so either you reinforce bad behaviors, because we can agree a 3-day bender, like how is that serving you? How is that serving you? And mind you, this is me, right? Like very lovingly, this was exactly me. 3-day bender, 5-day bender. Like we're going to go, let's go.
Yeah.
But so the issue is that once that dopamine hits the frontal lobe, I can either feel shame and like have that like identity crisis and really feel wounded. And that shame usually comes with, if people knew this about me, they wouldn't accept me. So now I feel isolation. Now I feel separation. Potentially that tribalism again is getting triggered. But the only way that I know how to sit with that emotion is by turning back to the drug, the addiction, the thing in the first place. So that's what creates that downward spiral is shame story comes up. I don't know how to sit with that emotion. So then I'm turning back to the addiction in the first place. And so that's when, again, like that we're just kicking the can down the road of not being willing to feel the thing that we were supposed to feel in the first place. And the justification story is the same. I'm not willing to feel shame at all. I'm unwilling to feel that. And so I'm going to justify it. Oh, I just do this for fun. Oh, I just do this to relax. Oh, I just do this to insert any number of things. Oh, all of my friends do it. I'm justifying it with some level of acceptance, community, belonging, and a perspective that helps me feel safe. We live in a culture that celebrates gluttony. We live in a culture that celebrates using and imbibing in alcohol, in marijuana, in cigarettes. Like we celebrate all of those things. You're the weird one when you don't imbibe in those things. When I cut out alcohol, I had to practice and reinforce saying, I don't drink. 1,000 times over. And I had to sit with a visceral experience, having been the fun guy, the party lover, the one that was like the talk of every party. Like I wanted to keep the party going until as many late hours as I possibly could. When I finally got to a point where I cut out alcohol, I had to sit with the visceral discomfort of the belief or the story that I'm telling myself is that friends are scarce and I have to drink in order to have friends.
Yeah, that was a big thing that I wanted to mention on here and just ask you is, what did your life look like friendship-wise, acceptance-wise, things like that, whenever you decided to not drink, whenever you decided to go on this journey, not just a sobriety journey, but like maybe even like a mentally freeing journey? And because my experience with, you know, I did a full year no alcohol or any substance. And that was just, you know, for myself, which I didn't expect to like lose relationships and lose touch with people over that. So that's why I'd be interested to know what your experience with that was.
Yeah. So I could definitely tell you, I was a terrible friend. not because of the fact of any of the, you know, drugs or alcohol or any of those things. It was more so because I didn't actually know how to be a brother to somebody. like all of the friends that I had, we were sort of just in competition with each other. We sort of only just reinforced the bad behaviors and all the things that we were doing. I only knew how to be the fun guy. I only knew how to be the person who was achieving, right? So I couldn't even really share these inner struggles because I was just kind of like, harden up, pussy. Like, what are you talking about? Don't. I was totally the person to reinforce that, right? And I did not know how to have the tough conversations, the conversation that says like, hey, actually, I'm struggling, man. I'm not doing great. And instead, I'll go all the time, celebrate my trophies. I'm celebrating even the friends that I did have, I only celebrated them when they were celebrating their trophies. And so I didn't know how to even be a brother to somebody in a very close and familiar way because I was still just posturing. I was still just competing. I was still, if there was any kind of dominance hierarchy to be had, I was trying to be at the top of it. So it wasn't enough for me to be somebody who rode motorcycles and had buddies who rode motorcycles. I had to have the fastest motorcycle. So it wasn't enough to have a 600cc bike. As soon as I could afford an 800cc bike, I did. And then it was a 1200cc bike. And then it wasn't just enough to ride it. You had to take it to the track and do a track day with a bike. All of those things, like those, again, the output by themselves, there's nothing wrong with the hobby of riding a motorcycle. There's nothing wrong with the hobby of taking a bike to a track day. It's exhilarating. The energy that was fueling it, though, was a need to perform, be dominant, reach the top of this whatever hierarchy. It was pressure and anxiety and stress and inadequacy or fear of it. That's why all of those things kind of came crumbling down. And when I finally really started this journey of, hey, who is the real Ian underlying all of this? And it's not to say that I can't have any fun anymore or I can't enjoy any dopamine. It's just that I'm only going to make sure I'm reinforcing behaviors, beliefs, and an identity that I want to see more of in community and receiving praise from people who are praising me for the right things that I want to see more of.
So how many years ago did you start that journey?
So that was end of 2020 that I really started honing in on the addictions, the behavioral psychology around addiction. I actually didn't even acknowledge that it was part of the ADHD experience. It was only probably 2 years ago or so where the ADHD experience started to become more of the underlying theme that it's like, wait, all of these patterns and strategies that I've built now, navigating these addictions and the porn addiction, binge eating, alcohol abuse, like all of it was really just like, oh, hey, this is all just unmanaged ADHD. And you're building these systems around an ADHD brain. And now that you give it language to that, oh, it actually makes things a lot easier. But yeah, again, it's 2020 is when it started. I'd say that I've leaned into the ADHD part of that experience over the course of the last 2 years.
Gotcha. It's just so interesting to me. I've never heard someone affiliate all of that to ADHD and put terms around it and know all the backstory around it, because I feel like the general public is, and just probably because people don't do their research or don't put two and two together, or maybe they don't have someone like you to have a realization with, is whenever you have a addiction, where it doesn't have to be like substances, it could be food or an activity or whatever. I think a lot of people, it's just like, go to a recovery setting because you are that person. And that's why when you're in those settings, you say, I am an... And this is just a whole new light of, okay, if you have ADHD, then unfortunately the people who don't and you're listening to this, you know, sorry, I guess.
I mean, anybody who's listening could be emotionally dysregulated and dopamine dysregulated, which kind of defines the ADHD experience. So even if you're not ADHD, you can benefit from learning how to emotionally regulate and how to direct your dopamine more effectively.
Yeah.
I don't get offended when people say of like, oh, everybody has a little ADHD. It's like, it's actually kind of offensive to people who actually have ADHD, but great. Then why aren't you learning about it? If everybody has a little bit of ADHD, then you shouldn't ignore it. You should study it.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I've cared to hone in on. But what I will tell you about the nature of the ADHD world right now, even amongst professionals, and this is therapists and so on, is that we can honestly simplify a good majority of the details around it. Of ADHD can be defined by heightened amygdala activity, an issue or decreased amount of dopamine and norepinephrine in the brain, and essentially managing sensitivity to dopamine. And if you get those three things right consistently, you will be able to direct your energy and attention and focus more consistently for the things that matter to you.
Well said. So let's talk about your coaching and kind of your, let's talk about your ideal client. Let's talk about, you know, what you look to identify initially with some of these clients for some of our listeners who are like, wow, I could benefit from talking to a guy like Ian on a more regular basis.
Yeah, so I actually just recently launched a school community. So I'll send you the link to that so you can post it in the show notes. The beauty of that is I talk about some of those simple process and operations, as well as some of the key components that I talk about when it comes to ADHD performance, right? And I will tell you the difference between me as an ADHD coach versus an ADHD therapist is that if you're late stage diagnosed, an ADHD therapist can be really helpful in you reprocessing a lot of your emotional experiences, big T and little T trauma from your life, that now that you have the language of ADHD, that you can go reprocess some of those memories. Oh, hey, this was actually my ADHD. And now, hey, here's where dysregulation was showing up. And now I can actually give myself grace and forgive some of my maladaptive behaviors. ADHD therapy is great for that. So if you're coming in to a conversation with me, I very well might direct you to an ADHD-informed therapist rather than doing the coaching, because I think that there's somewhat of a need for that. If your goal within a coaching container with me as a coach, the goal should very well be of like, hey, we're going to focus on output. We're going to focus on how do we turn on intensity without burnout. And I am capable of being a burnout coach, right? I've experienced it. I know how that works. There's nuances though to the state of a client who is in a season of burnout, because it is radical change that needs to be made. Pulling back from your role and responsibilities within your business, pulling back from potentially some of the ways that you're showing up within your communities, right? And your volunteer time and some of these additional projects. Like, you might have to pull back so you can really give yourself the emotional energy and attention that it needs so that you can be more regulated. But when it comes to performance, it's, hey, we can develop some of these patterns and strategies so that you're making sure that the agency that you have over your time is actually being well used. So for the person listening, I would tell you the people that I work best with are usually executive leaders, sales reps, but then also more recently, business owners, because there's a good amount of components. If you're starting a new business and you're sort of a solopreneur, what operations are the most likely that are going to get you the success that you need, bring you more clients? There's consistent practices and habits that you're going to need to be very good at. How do we make the boring, mundane tasks repeatable and more likely for you to actually perform them? Because you can logically know what you should be doing and still be sitting in your chair not doing anything but those things. You're updating your website. You're making t-shirt designs.
Did that last night.
Yeah. No, same. I have this cool design. I have a cool ADHD logo. It's this dude flexing. It's great colors. It's super fun. It was an ADHD side project. My business is not successful because of it. Right. And so those are the things where when you're working with somebody who is an ADHD informed performance coach, of we can remove the complexity of the tasks that are going to increase the likelihood of your success. So somebody having that experience and knowledge is going to be helpful in getting you there. Yeah, that's a succinct part of it. But I'm on LinkedIn, and that school community are probably the best ways to reach me.
Okay, and you have a website, correct?
I do, but it is going to be revamped soon. So okay. If you're there now and it doesn't look modern, wait.
Well, yeah.
Well, the better place to reach me is my LinkedIn.
Okay, great. So the coaching as a whole is not only the mental side of it, the ADHD side of it, but it's also directly tied in with like your knowledge of business and sales and things like that, to where, because a therapist will help you with the mental side of it if they don't understand the business side of it, but you're kind of meshing the two a little bit.
Yeah, so my background in sales, I was actually a software web and app dev consultant. So in the 12 years that I was in sales, a large majority of that was working with executive leaders, process and operations management. And so a good majority of my clients are usually people who are still in that space, because then I can help them, again, remove the complexity of their roles. So I'm very familiar with the sales lifecycle, very familiar with how do you take a particular persona through a sales process. What does it look like for doing cold outreach, cold emailing, cold messaging? If you're a product owner, what types of processes and habits do you need to have to manage your time and the time of a 30-person dev team? So, I mean, the benefit of that is like, we don't necessarily even just have to talk about the theory of what your biggest blockers are. It's, we can navigate the emotional experience, create some awareness around it, build up some specific tasks that need to be repeated consistently, and then give you more tools and resources to increase the likelihood that you follow through. Deep breath. It's a lot. And you're like, okay, this is intense. I don't know if I can keep up with all that.
No, it's great. I'm thinking about, honestly, selfishly, how could this benefit me and some of the people that are close to me, really. So.
And that, for to be honest, join the school community. I'll tell you, I'm continuing every single day, adding more tools, more resources, more curriculum there that still looks at it from a high level. I can't necessarily offer specific scenarios in a community and a group environment like that. If you really need to focus on what are the biggest blockers for you personally, your own emotional blockers, typical cycles of overwhelm, as well as, hey, what tasks can we simplify, right? You've heard of the 80-20 rule of what 20% tasks are going to yield 80% of the results, and being able to develop and deploy those. Now, part of the beauty of the one-on-one coaching, though, is that I provide, yeah, in our one-on-one sessions, we can talk about what those things are. And then I also provide body doubling. And so right now I offer 3 hours per week where we get on a call, we do a little bit of mindfulness and calm our amygdala nervous system, and then we set our intention for that period of time. And so the beauty of that is we're in connection, we're community, right? Like, your brain right now is lit up. So if we're going to, we could probably get some stuff done right now just from the safety, community, connection, and belonging that we've built in this space. And hey, we don't have to talk. I'm going to be clackety clacking on my keyboard, getting some of my boring admin stuff done. So are you. And that actually increases the likelihood of focus and follow through, statistically right now, is by up to 50% more productivity in that period of time. So wow. If you could have 3 hours per week of double the productivity, like, what would that mean for you? What would that mean for your business? What would that mean for your ability to go perform and tackle the things in front of you?
Yeah. Wow. That's a, I really appreciate your insights. I think that they're extremely unique in a really great way. So hopefully that lands as a compliment to you.
Yeah, I received that. Thank you, Mike.
Absolutely. Last thing, is to any of our listeners who are struggling, I ask this on every episode, you know, what would you say to that person that's, you know, can relate to what you've said today, can relate to some of this, even maybe a piece of it, that's just struggling and doesn't really know where to begin, and they're not really trying to go the therapy route, and they just don't know?
Yeah, so the first thing I want to share is, one, you're not broken. The identity crisis of the I'm lazy story, I must not want it enough story, oh, I have so much potential. You're not broken. And so some of these are all skills. And the beauty of when we can acknowledge it as a skill is we can start small and we can progressively grow and develop skills. And then the final thing of all of it is, like, yes, you're not broken, but the other part of, it's okay that it's hard. And there's not enough people who are willing to acknowledge that it's okay that it's hard. Because we all have a story that says it's hard for me, but it's not hard for anybody else. And then again, therefore, I'm the problem. There must be something wrong with me. I'm broken. So yeah, those two things, honestly, is what I would share with somebody who's in the middle of that struggle.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Ian. Ian May, everyone. Appreciate you coming on, and looking forward to talking soon.
Appreciate it.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces, hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.